Welcome to Saving Castles, the podcast for castle and chateau enthusiasts. Join us as we explore the fascinating history, stories, and culture of these awe-inspiring structures, from the legends and folklore to the latest in restoration. We'll cover it all, so whether you're a seasoned castle aficionado or just discovering the magic of these magnificent buildings, this is the podcast for you. So grab your headphones and let's dive in.
In the shadowed halls of a cold stone fortress, a young boy, no older than 5, clutched a worn doll, his knuckles white against its faded cloth. The fortress had walls thick enough to withstand sieges. Its towers stretched towards the heavens like the fingers of giants. Yet for this young boy, its immense walls felt more like a cage. This was William Marshall, a child caught in the chaos of the anarchy, a period where England was torn asunder by the claims of 2 would-be monarchs. On one side stood King Stephen of Blois, a man with a firm grip on the throne, yet constantly haunted by the spectre of doubt over his legitimacy. On the other, the formidable Empress Matilda, daughter of King Henry I, and a woman determined to assert her birthright. Their war over the crown would pull the realm into 2 decades of bloodshed and unrest. Amid this turmoil, young William became an unexpected pawn, as the son of a minor nobleman, John Marshall, who shifted his support between Stephen and Matilda as he saw fit. William found himself thrust into a world of political machinations far beyond his tender years. John had fortified Newbury Castle against King Stephen, and when the king laid siege, the outcome looked grim for John's forces. But here's where the tale takes a dark twist. In a bid to secure his own son's safety and by time, John offered young William as a hostage, a guarantee of his good faith and future surrender. The king, with a glint in his eye, accepted. Yet, when it became evident that John Marshall had no intention of keeping his word, Stephen, exasperated by John's deceit, threatened to catapult young William over the walls of the besieged castle, to which John famously retorted that he still had the anvils and hammers to forge even finer sons. It's easy to gasp at such seemingly callous indifference, yet it paints a vivid picture of the ruthlessness of medieval politics, where the lines between personal ambition and familial duty often blurred. But for William, it was a baptism by fire. Despite the threat, King Stephen, unable to bring himself to harm the innocent boy, spared him. Many whispered that the king had seen something remarkable in the child's eyes, a steely resolve that belied his tender age. As the years unfolded, William's life became an intricate tapestry of knighthood, stitched with threads of honour, courage, and diplomacy. Yet those early years, filled with the echoes of clashing swords, the mournful cries of war-torn villages, and the shadow of treacherous castle walls, were formative. They shaped the mettle of the man who would emerge from the crucible of conflict, not just as a knight, but as the very embodiment of chivalry. Indeed, it is in such tumultuous backdrops that legends are born. And as history would later attest, the trials of his youth served only to temper William's spirit, forging an indomitable will that neither sword nor circumstance could shatter. As castle enthusiasts, you know that the strongest fortresses often have the most battle scars. Similarly, the makings of William Marshall as the realm's greatest knight began, not on the jousting fields or in the grand courts, but in the shadowed corridors of a besieged castle, as a young boy caught in the midst of an empire's storm. We shall trace the arc of William's life from those perilous beginnings to his rise as an unparalleled figure of knighthood. Remember that cold fortress, the weight of the crown's politics, and a young boy's unwavering gaze. For in his story, we find the essence of what it means to be truly tempered by valor. The glint of sunlight on steel, the muffled thud of wooden swords, and the persistent chime of a smithy in the distance painted the backdrop of William Marshall's adolescent years. As the embers of the anarchy cooled and England entered a period of uneasy stability, William, no longer a mere pawn in a grand game, was apprenticed as a squire. Being a squire was more than just a title. It was a rite of passage. Every young noble lad dreamt of earning his spurs. But first, they must tread the path of service and learn the codes of chivalry, both in theory and in practice. For young William, the world of squires was both an academy and an arena. It was here, under the stern gaze of seasoned knights, that he would receive the training to harness his raw potential. One can imagine a younger William, sweat glistening on his brow as he engaged in rigorous training drills. He would have practiced the melee, where teams of knights and squires clashed in controlled chaos. These mock battles were not mere games. They were simulations designed to prepare young men for the brutal reality of medieval warfare. Every thrust, parry, and dodge William executed was a dance of survival. Yet even amid this environment, William stood out. There were tales whispered among the squires. How William could unhorse a knight with a single, well-timed thrust, or how his strategies in the mock battles often led his team to victory. His commitment to excelling was evident, and soon tales of his prowess started trickling into the courts and halls of England. The medieval world placed immense emphasis on honour and reputation. The word of a knight, his oath, was his bond. As such, the accolade, or the ritual of becoming a knight, was more than just a ceremony. It symbolised one's entry into an elite brotherhood, bound by duty, honour, and valour. For William, this moment came sooner than most. In a setting steeped in solemnity, with nobles and knights as witnesses, William was knighted. As the flat edge of the sword touched his shoulders, bestowing upon him this honour, it was as if time itself held its breath. The weight of the blade was nothing compared to the weight of the responsibility that now rested upon him. In that hushed silence, punctuated only by the soft murmurs of prayer, William Marshall transitioned from a promising squire to a knight, a protector of the realm. This transition wasn't just symbolic. As a knight, William would now be expected to serve his liege in war, counsel him in peace, and above all, uphold the chivalric code. Knights were more than just warriors. They were the moral compass of medieval society, expected to embody virtues such as loyalty, bravery, and courtesy. It's worth noting that while knighthood was often the domain of the nobility, it was not guaranteed. Many a noble scion failed to attain this honour, their names lost to the annals of history. Yet William, a boy once threatened with a trebuchet, now stood among the ranks of the realm's defenders. His early years had been a crucible, and his time as a squire had honed his skills. But with knighthood, a new chapter began, one filled with tournaments, battles, and political intrigue. If the life of a squire was a rehearsal, the life of a knight was the grand performance, with all of medieval society as its audience. As we delve deeper into William's story, remember this moment of transition. For in this transformation from squire to knight lies a lesson. That life is not determined by the circumstances of one's birth or the trials of one's youth. Instead, it is shaped by the choices one makes, the honour one upholds, and the challenges one overcomes. The sun cast its brilliant rays upon the sprawling meadow, turning the ground into a vast canvas of gold and green, tints of vibrant hues, blue, red, and purple, lined its periphery, their banners fluttering like the wings of majestic birds. Nobles, clad in their finest silks, chatted animatedly while minstrels strummed lively tunes. But the true spectacle lay at the heart of this gathering. The tournament ground. Amidst the sounds of trilling trumpets, the herald announced the names of the participating knights. One name, in particular, sent ripples of anticipation through the crowd, Sir William Marshall. Tournaments in the 12th century were not the chivalric affairs of later periods, characterized by jousting and courteous gestures. No, these were brutal mock battles, mirroring the chaos and intensity of genuine warfare. Participating knights sought to capture their opponents, not for glory alone, but for ransom. A successful knight could earn a small fortune through these events, and for many, the line between warfare and these contests was wafer thin. William's entry into this world of tournaments was not just a testament to his martial skills, but also a strategic move. With each victory, his coffers swelled, and so did his reputation. His strategy was unmatched. While others charged headlong into battle, William displayed an uncanny ability to anticipate moves, making his charges with precision and purpose. He became a force to reckon with, not just for his strength, but for his intellect. Witnesses spoke of a particular event where William, against overwhelming odds, outmaneuvered his opponents, capturing several knights in a brilliant tactical move. The cheers of the crowd were deafening, but amidst the jubilation, William's eyes remained focused, always seeking the next challenge, the next opponent. His prowess in tournaments also led him to introduce an innovation that changed their very nature, the concept of ransoming. Instead of injuring or even killing an opponent, William saw the economic value in capturing and then ransoming them. This strategy was twofold. It ensured a steady income and elevated his standing as a chivalrous knight, respectful even in the heat of battle. However, it wasn't all about the money. Tournaments were social events, drawing the attention of the most influential figures of the realm. Every maneuver William executed on the field was also a dance in the grand ballroom of politics and influence. His victories caught the attention of the powerful, including the mesmerizing Eleanor of Aquitaine and her sons. As he became a sought-after figure in courts, his tournament wins became more than just personal accolades. They became political statements. Imagine, if you will, the electric atmosphere of such a tournament, the ground scarred by the hooves of charging horses and the clash of steel, the air thick with dust and the raw emotion of combat. In the midst of it all, a figure, armor gleaming even through the grime of battle, moving with grace and purpose. That was William Marshall, the embodiment of knightly prowess. Yet for all his victories, William never lost sight of the true essence of these contests. Beneath the violence and strategy, tournaments were about honor. In an age where a knight's reputation was his most valuable asset, William's conduct in tournaments set him apart. He fought with valor, yes, but also with respect. His opponents, even in defeat, found in him a worthy adversary, one who recognized and honored their skills. As the sun set on each tournament day, painting the sky in hues of crimson and amber, and as the crowds dispersed, tales of William's deeds spread far and wide. From the taverns of England to the courts of Europe, everyone spoke of the knight who fought not just with his sword, but with his heart and mind. In the grand halls of Poitiers, amidst the soft glow of candles and the intricate tapestries depicting tales of yore, a formidable figure held court. Eleanor of Aquitaine, Duchess, Queen, and a force of nature in her own right. Her presence was magnetic, drawing courtiers, knights, and scholars alike into her orbit. A woman who had once been queen of both France and England, her life was a tapestry of political intrigue, passionate romance, and unyielding ambition. Enter into this world a newly minted knight, William Marshall, his reputation from the tournament fields preceding him. But Eleanor's court wasn't just any court. It was the epicenter of culture, politics, and most importantly, the chivalric code. It was here that the idea of courtly love blossomed, where knights would dedicate their feats to noble ladies, elevating them to near divine status. William, ever the astute observer, recognized the significance of serving under Eleanor. While his prowess on the battlefield was unparalleled, Eleanor's court offered him an education of a different kind. In the intricate dance of courtly politics, in diplomacy, and in the ideals of knighthood. Under Eleanor's patronage, William's role wasn't limited to that of a mere bodyguard or a knight in her service. She recognized in him a kindred spirit, a blend of strength and sagacity. Together, they navigated the tumultuous waters of Plantagenet politics, with Eleanor guiding him, molding him into a statesman. Their bond grew deep, rooted in mutual respect and an understanding of the delicate balance of power. Yet, it wasn't just Eleanor who saw William's worth. Her sons, the future kings of England too, came to rely on him. William's bond with the young Henry, Eleanor's favoured son, was particularly poignant. They shared not just a master-squire relationship, but one of deep friendship. In the echo-filled halls of the castle, one could often hear the laughter of the young prince and his knight, practicing their swordplay or discussing strategy. This association was not without its tests. The era was marked by rebellions, wars, and familial betrayals. Eleanor's sons, especially the young and fiery Henry, often found themselves in opposition to their father, King Henry II. And William, he was torn between loyalty to Eleanor and her sons, and the oath he had sworn to the king. Imagine a cold winter night, a clandestine meeting in the woods where young Henry and a group of rebellious barons plotted against the king. In the flickering firelight one could see the silhouette of William, his loyalty to the young prince evident, yet his inner turmoil palpable. He was treading a treacherous path, one demanded the wisdom of Solomon. Eleanor, ever the matriarch, often found herself as the mediator with William by her side, ensuring that the fires of rebellion did not consume the very fabric of the Plantagenet dynasty. His role went beyond that of a knight. He became a confidant, advisor, and at times the voice of reason. In the courts of Europe, the tale of William's dedication became legendary. It was said that during a particularly heated rebellion, when young Henry lay on his deathbed, struck down by fever, it was William who stayed by his side, comforting him, whispering words of courage, and ensuring the prince did not die alone. Such was the depth of his loyalty. Yet, amidst the political storms, there were moments of respite. Under Eleanor's guidance, William also became a patron of the arts, immersing himself in the world of poetry, music, and courtly romance. The knight, known for his combat prowess, also became celebrated for his refined tastes and his understanding of the softer, more nuanced aspects of chivalry. Eleanor's court, with its blend of politics, art, and chivalry, was the crucible in which the legend of William Marshall was forged, not just as the greatest knight, but as a symbol of what knighthood truly represented. In his unwavering loyalty, in his dedication to the ideals of chivalry, and in his service to a queen who was a legend in her own right, William's story became inextricably intertwined with the very essence of the Plantagenet dynasty. Normandy, with its rugged coastline and verdant fields, has always been a land of strategic significance. Situated just across the English Channel, its fate and fortune have long been intertwined with England. In the late 12th century, as William Marshall's reputation soared, Normandy would become the stage for one of the most pivotal chapters of his life. To understand the magnitude of William's role in defending Normandy, one must first grasp its geopolitical importance. As the ancestral lands of the Plantagenet dynasty, Normandy was not just a piece of real estate. It was the heart of an empire that stretched from the Scottish borders to the Pyrenees. By the 1190s, however, clouds of war loomed over this prosperous region. Philip II of France, an ambitious monarch with dreams of expanding his dominion, cast covetous eyes on Normandy, and William Marshall, by now a seasoned warrior and diplomat, was entrusted with its defense. Imagine for a moment the imposing silhouette of Chateau Gaillard perched defiantly atop a limestone cliff overlooking the Seine. Dubbed the Key to Normandy, this fortress, with its triple set of walls and innovative defences, was the brainchild of Richard the Lionheart, King of England. As Philip's forces approached, William, understanding the castle's strategic importance, took command of its defence. The ensuing siege was not merely a military confrontation, it was a clash of wills. On one side stood the formidable French army, their numbers swelling like a tide, their intent clear. On the other, a smaller but resolute garrison, led by William, their spirits unyielding, even in the face of overwhelming odds. The days turned into weeks, and the weeks into months. The sounds of battering rams, the hiss of arrows, and the roar of the fighting became a relentless symphony of war. Yet, amidst this cacophony, one could discern the strategic genius of William Marshall. Employing a blend of guerrilla tactics, diplomacy, and sheer resilience, he held the French at bay, turning Chateau Gaillard into an unbreachable bastion. Stories of William's defiance spread like wildfire. Tales told of how, even when faced with starvation, the garrison, inspired by William's indomitable spirit, resorted to eating their horses, yet refused to surrender. On another occasion, when a portion of the walls was breached, William, donning his armor, personally led a sortie, driving the French back and sealing the breach. Yet it wasn't just about combat. William, always the diplomat, continually sought to negotiate, to find a peaceful resolution even in the heart of conflict. He corresponded with Philip, proposing terms, ensuring that while he defended the castle with sword and shield, he also wielded the quill with equal dexterity. However, the geopolitical landscape was shifting. With the death of Richard the Lionheart and the ascension of his brother John, the dynamics changed. King John, lacking his brother's military acumen and charisma, struggled to hold on to the vast Angevin Empire. Amidst this turbulence, William's role became even more crucial. He was not just the defender of a castle. He was the bulwark against the disintegration of an empire. As the months wore on, the situation grew dire. Supplies dwindled and the specter of defeat loomed large. Yet William, ever the beacon of hope, rallied his troops, reminding them of their duty not just to a piece of land but to an ideal, to the very concept of loyalty and defiance in the face of overwhelming odds. In the annals of history, Normandy would eventually fall to the French. But the resistance, the unyielding spirit showcased by William and his men, would echo through time. For here was a knight who stood tall, not for personal glory, but for a cause, for the defense of a realm, and for the honor of his king. In the chronicles of medieval warfare, the defense of Normandy, led by William Marshall, stands out not as a tale of victory or defeat, but as a testament to the indomitable human spirit, a reminder that true valor is often showcased not in the face of victory, but in the shadow of impending defeat. In the vast tapestry of medieval Europe, interwoven with tales of valor, intrigue, and ambition, there are threads of tender, genuine affection. Such is the story of William Marshall and Isabel de Clare. While battles and politics shape the contours of their lives, at the heart of their tale is a profound human connection. Isabel, daughter of the mighty Richard de Clare, known as Strongbow, was an heiress of immense value. With lands stretching across England, Wales, and Ireland, she was not merely a woman. She was a living legacy, a key to power and influence. Yet, behind the grandeur and titles, Isabel was also a young woman, with dreams, aspirations, and a yearning for genuine companionship. Their union, at first glance, bore the unmistakable hallmarks of medieval politics. William, having carved a name for himself through sheer prowess and dedication, stood at the threshold of true power. Marrying Isabel was not merely a personal decision. It was a strategic move, a union of the sword and the scroll. It promised William lands, wealth, and a firmer footing in the treacherous sands of Plantagenet politics. Yet, to reduce their marriage to mere politics would be an oversimplification, for beneath the strategic veneer there was warmth, respect, and a shared vision. Picture the sprawling castle of Pembroke, its walls echoing tales of conquests and alliances. Within its confines, William and Isabel charted the course of their shared destiny. Isabel, well-educated and astute, was not a silent partner. She played an active role in managing their vast estates, ensuring they flourished. Their letters, preserved through time, speak of shared decisions, of lands acquired, disputes resolved, and policies enacted. Beyond the stone walls and administrative scrolls, their bond deepened. They were often seen riding together, surveying their lands or engrossed in discussions late into the night by the flickering candlelight. They were equals, partners in every sense, and their respect for each other was evident to all. In a world where women, especially of noble birth, were often pawns in the great game of dynastic politics, Isabel's role in William's life was revolutionary. She was his confidant, adviser, and the anchor that grounded him, and he, in return, was her protector, ally, and companion. As the years rolled on, their family grew. 10 children were born of their union, each a testament to their enduring bond. Through rebellions, wars, and the ever-shifting landscape of medieval politics, their bond remained unbroken. In moments of crisis, it was to Isabel that William turned, seeking solace, advice, or simply the comfort of her presence. Perhaps one of the most poignant tales of their bond comes from a time of immense personal trial. As William prepared to leave for a campaign, Isabel, heavily pregnant with their child, expressed a desire to accompany him. Recognizing the risks, yet unable to deny her, William made arrangements for a lavish tent, ensuring her comfort. There, amidst the tumult of war, their child was born, a beacon of hope and love in uncertain times. Their relationship, while rooted in medieval norms, transcended its era. It spoke of a partnership based on mutual respect, shared ambitions, and genuine affection. Isabel was not just William's wife, she was an integral part of his legacy. Together, they navigated the challenges of their age, leaving behind an indelible mark. As we delve deeper into the annals of history, amidst tales of knights and castles, battles and betrayals, it's stories like William and Isabel's that remind us of the human essence that underpins it all. For, at the heart of grand events and epic sagas, lie simple tales of love, companionship, and shared dreams. To understand William Marshall, the knight par excellence, one must also recognize Isabel de Clare, the woman who stood by him, shaping and sharing his destiny. Their story, intertwined with the larger narrative of medieval Europe, is a poignant reminder that behind every great man, there often stands an equally remarkable woman. The turn of the 13th century witnessed England standing on a precipice, a precarious blend of restive barons, regional conflicts, and a king often described as capricious King John. Into this volatile mix stood William Marshall, no longer just a knight or a noble, but a linchpin of the realm. King John, for all his flaws, was not a simple caricature of tyranny. He was a product of his lineage, his times, and the weighty legacy of his forefathers, but his reign was marked by discontent. The barons grew restless, feeling marginalized and disregarded. Their grievances, though varied, converged on a singular demand: the need for a charter, a document that would bind the king and ensure that his rule was not arbitrary but governed by the law. Enter William Marshall, a man whose reputation was built on loyalty, valor, and an uncanny ability to navigate the treacherous waters of medieval politics. By now, William was no stranger to the intricacies of power. His association with the Plantagenet dynasty, his vast lands, and his role as a trusted advisor made him an obvious choice to mediate between the king and the disgruntled barons. Imagine the scene at Runnymede, a meadow by the River Thames, in June 1215. Tents peppered the landscape and banners flapped in the wind. At one end stood King John, surrounded by his loyalists. At the other, a coalition of barons, their faces etched with determination. And in between, striving to bridge the chasm, was William Marshall. The negotiations were intense. The air was thick with tension, every word weighed down by its implications. Yet William, with his diplomatic acumen, managed to ensure that dialogue, not conflict, prevailed. It was a delicate balancing act, recognizing the legitimate grievances of the barons, while ensuring that the monarchy's authority remained intact. The result? The Magna Carta, a foundational document that promised to limit the powers of the king and safeguard the rights of the nobles. But its significance transcended the immediate political context. It was a beacon, albeit a flawed one, signalling the dawn of constitutional governance, an idea that power must always be accountable. But William's role didn't end with the sealing of the Magna Carta. The document, while revolutionary, was also divisive. Many, including King John himself, were reluctant to adhere to its stipulations. This reluctance culminated in the First Barons' War, a civil conflict that threatened to tear the realm asunder. During this tumultuous period, William's loyalty to the crown never wavered, even when it might have been politically expedient to do otherwise. He was the stalwart defender of the Plantagenet legacy, standing firm amidst the shifting sands of rebellion and intrigue. The climax of this conflict, and a testament to William's military genius, was the Battle of Lincoln in 1217. With the city besieged by the rebels and the odds stacked against the royalist forces, William, despite his advancing age, donned his armor and led a charge that would turn the tide of the battle. It was a decisive victory, one that underscored his reputation as a warrior and tactician. Yet, for all his martial prowess, William Marshall's true legacy during this period was his statesmanship. He recognized that for England to prosper, it needed stability, not endless conflict. His efforts, post the Battle of Lincoln, were focused on ensuring peace. The result was the Treaty of Lambeth, which brought an end to the Civil War and reissued the Magna Carta, reaffirming its principles. In the grand narrative of England's history, the Magna Carta stands out as a symbol, a testament to the idea that rulers, no matter how powerful, are bound by the law, and behind this document, ensuring its creation, preservation, reservation, and implementation, was William Marshall. His role during this pivotal period was not just that of a warrior or a diplomat, but of a guardian of the realm, its values, and its future. In the shadow of the Magna Carta, amidst the echoes of battles and the murmurs of negotiations, stands the figure of William Marshall, the embodiment of loyalty, duty, and unwavering commitment to the greater good. The twilight years of William Marshall's life were anything but quiet reflections of a life well lived. With King John's untimely death in 1216, the English crown passed on to young hands, those of a 9-year-old Henry III. The realm, still reeling from the aftershocks of rebellion and political turmoil, needed a guiding hand, a beacon of stability. It was a moment that called for wisdom, experience, and an unwavering commitment to the English crown. The realm turned its gaze towards William Marshall. In the sacred halls of Gloucester Cathedral, amidst the solemnity of stained glass and echoing chants, young Henry was crowned, but the true weight of the realm rested on William's aging shoulders, for he was named the regent, the protector of both the young king and the kingdom. This was not merely an honorary title, it was a profound responsibility. As regent, William was tasked with the governance of the kingdom, ensuring its stability and, most importantly, safeguarding the young king from the myriad threats that lurked in the shadows. Imagine the corridors of power whispering with intrigue and ambition. Nobles, sensing an opportunity with a child on the throne, would have schemed for greater power. Others might have seen this as a chance to break away, to carve out their own fiefdoms. Against this backdrop, William had to navigate, often making tough decisions, striking a balance between assertion and diplomacy. One of his first acts as regent was to reissue the Magna Carta. Recognizing the Charter's symbolic and practical importance, William ensured that its principles were firmly entrenched, serving as a bridge between the crown and the restless barons. But governance wasn't his only challenge. External threats loomed large. Prince Louis of France, with an eye on the English crown, posed a formidable challenge. Marshalling his forces, he faced the French in a series of engagements, utilizing his decades of battlefield experience. His strategies, a blend of martial prowess and diplomatic acumen, ensured that the French threat was neutralized and the young king's position solidified. Yet, amidst the challenges of regency, one can glimpse moments of tenderness. Chronicles speak of William's interactions with young Henry, mentoring sessions that went beyond matters of state. He imparted to the young king lessons on knighthood, honour, and the weighty responsibilities of wearing a crown. In the young monarch's eyes, William was more than a regent. He was a mentor, a guiding star. But time, the one opponent no knight can defeat, was catching up with William. As he felt his strength wane, he began ensuring a stable transition. Recognizing the importance of continuity, he gathered around young Henry a council of trusted advisers, ensuring that when he was gone, the king would not stand alone. The final chapter of William's illustrious life was one of introspection and faith. He sponsored the construction of a new priory in London, the Temple Church, which stands to this day as a testament to his piety and his dedication to the Templar order. As the sun set on his life in May 1219, William Marshall lay on his deathbed, but even in his final moments his thoughts were for England and its young king. His last act, a testament to his life's guiding principles, was to take the habit of the Templar, surrendering to faith, duty, and honour. In the annals of history, many have worn the mantle of power, but few have done so with the grace, dedication, and unwavering commitment of William Marshall. As regent, his role was not just that of a guardian to a young king, but of a steward to an entire kingdom. He held the fabric of England together during one of its most vulnerable moments, ensuring that the Plantagenet legacy lived on. Behind the titles, the battles, and the political maneuvers stands the figure of a man, a knight, a statesman, and a mentor whose life serves as a shining example of what it means to truly serve, to dedicate oneself to a cause greater than oneself. In the shadows of ancient stone halls and the hushed whispers of medieval courts, stories are born. They are tales of valour, honour, and indomitable spirit woven into the very fabric of a culture. And amongst these legends, one name echoes with unparalleled reverence, William Marshall. Years after his passing, the essence of William did not fade. If anything, it became more radiant, filtering through the ages, capturing the imagination of many generations. How does a man ascend from mortality of life to the immortality of legend? To understand this, one must delve into the rich tapestry of medieval chronicles and ballads that sang praises of William's deeds. His life, already storied and full of adventure, became a favorite topic for bards and chroniclers. The Histoire de Guillaume le Maréchal, an epic poem comprising over 19,000 lines, is one such chronicle that stands as a testament to William's legacy. Commissioned by his family, this detailed narrative paints a vivid picture of William's journey, from his humble beginnings to his pinnacle as the guardian of England. Imagine a medieval gathering, the room dimly lit by flickering candles. As the bard begins to recite, listeners are transported to the jousting fields where a young William showcased his prowess, to the courts where his wisdom prevailed, and to the battlefields where his valour shone brightest. The verses, rich in detail and drama, brought William to life, ensuring that his legend was passed down through the ages. But it wasn't just grand epics that celebrated William. In the bustling markets and along the dusty roads, travelling minstrels sang ballads of his chivalry. These shorter, often more embellished accounts made William Marshall a household name. Children would play, act his duels. Elders would reminisce about the golden era under his guardianship. Yet, beyond the verses and melodies, what truly immortalized William Marshall was the resonance of his values. He wasn't just remembered for his deeds, but for the principles he embodied: honor, duty, loyalty, and an unwavering commitment to the realm. In an age characterized by shifting allegiances and political intrigue, William's steadfastness made him an exemplar of chivalry. His portrayal in literature and song provided a template for subsequent generations. Knights aspired to emulate his code, rulers sought to govern with his wisdom, and scholars dissected his life, seeking insights into the medieval world. In many ways, the tales and ballads of William Marshall became instructional, setting a standard for what it meant to be noble, both in title and in spirit. And as the Middle Ages gave way to the Renaissance and beyond, the interest in William did not wane. Historians, armed with quills and ink, took up the task of dissecting his life, drawing from ancient manuscripts and chronicles. Through their writings, William Marshall transitioned from the realm of folklore to the annals of documented history. The numerous castles and fortresses he helped construct, the laws he influenced, the battles he fought, all became subjects of intense study. Academic conferences deliberated on his strategies, playwrights dramatized his duels, and authors penned novels inspired by his adventures. However, the true essence of William Marshall's enduring legacy lies not just in the pages of history books or the verses of ballads. It thrives in the collective consciousness of a culture that values honor and duty. It resonates in the stories parents tell their children, in the lessons mentors impart to their protégés, and in the aspirations of a nation that sees in William Marshall the embodiment of its highest ideals. In the vast expanse of time, many names fade, their achievements eroded by the sands of time. But then, there are those like William Marshall, whose essence becomes timeless and illuminates the path for generations to come. His presence, while no longer of flesh and blood, is enshrined not only in written records and tales passed down, but also in enduring stone and the spirit of places that witnessed his life's journey. The winding River Thames, coursing through the heart of London, has seen empires rise and fall. But on its banks stands a testament to Marshall's dedication to faith and chivalry. The Temple Church, while London has grown and transformed around it, this ancient edifice, with its distinct round nave and effigies of knights in repose, remains untouched by time. One can almost hear the echoes of ancient chants, the murmurs of Templar knights, and among them the figure of William Marshall in his final act of piety. Visitors, scholars, and historians who walk through the hallowed aisles of the Temple Church often find themselves in awe of Marshall's tomb. It's not just a resting place, but a beacon, an everlasting tribute to the greatest knight. His effigy, carved with meticulous detail, captures the essence of the man. The serene expression, the armor representing his martial prowess, and the crossed legs, a symbol of his unyielding crusader spirit. But Marshall's legacy is not confined to this church alone. It's woven into the very fabric of England. Across the countryside, remnants of his influence stand tall, castles and fortifications, though now mere ruins, whisper tales of his strategic genius. Places like Chepstow and Pembroke Castles, with their towering walls and strategic placements, are emblematic of his understanding of defense and sovereignty. Beyond these physical manifestations, Marshall's influence thrived in the cultural and political landscape of England. His reissuing of the Magna Carta was not just a tactical move to ensure peace, but a reflection of his understanding of governance and justice. It set in motion a series of events that would shape the very essence of Western democracy. Even in the complex tapestry of relationships within the Plantagenet dynasty, Marshall served as a binding force. Through feuds, rebellions, and shifting loyalties, he was the unwavering pillar that held the dynasty together, guiding it through its most tumultuous times. His counsel was not just sought in matters of war, but in the delicate intricacies of courtly politics. And as centuries rolled on, the reverence for Marshall did not diminish. If anything, it intensified. Victorian England, with its fascination for medieval chivalry and honour, rediscovered Marshall. His life became a subject of plays, novels, and scholarly treatises. In an era defined by the Industrial Revolution and rapid change, Marshall was a symbol of steadfastness and noble virtue. The Victorian admiration for Marshall was not just nostalgic, it was a longing for values that seemed timeless amidst a rapidly changing world. Today, in the 21st century, the world is a vastly different place from the medieval landscapes that William Marshall once traversed. Yet, in classrooms, scholarly conferences, historical reenactments, and popular culture, his name is invoked with the same reverence. His life serves as a bridge connecting epochs, reminding us of the enduring virtues of honor, duty, and unwavering commitment. The life of William Marshall, from his humble origins to his ascent as the protector of an entire realm, is not just the journey of an individual, but a reflection of an era. His legacy, enshrined in stone, parchment, and collective memory, is a testament to the indomitable human spirit. In the annals of history, while empires fade and dynasties crumble, the legacy of individuals like Marshall shines bright, serving as a beacon for all of humanity. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Saving Castles podcast. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll continue to explore the fascinating world of castles and chateaus. Don't miss out and subscribe to our podcast to get notified when new episodes are released. For more information about us and our work, visit savingcastles.com. Thank you for listening.